misstep. Ryan wore the handkerchief around his lower face again, partly to keep out the water and partly to keep warm. The storerooms had also yielded new socks and underwear, all of them thermal-lined. There hadn't been much in Albert's size, but the dwarf had made do. Jack knew what he was doing when he set the pitons. The redoubt had also contained an enormous amount of rope. Between the pitons and the rope, Ryan knew he and the teenager were crafting a stairway that the others could follow safely.
Ready?
Go!
Below Jack, Ryan dug into his position. The albino removed one of his safety harnesses and latched it to the new piton he had in place. He pulled himself up and tied on to the new one, then reached for another piton. Ryan hung on, feeling the wind pull at him with icy claws. It took more than 2 hours for all of them to reach the summit of the iceberg. Ryan stared out over the uneven terrain at the top. During the long climb, he had imagined several different ways that it might have looked. Seeing it still seemed a little stunning. The top of the glacier was made up of a number of plateaus. Several of them held jagged edges, showing how the frozen surface had shaped, then been reshaped by the elements. It was a nightmare rendered in cold white edges, stretching out as far as his eye could see.
Dark night. All I've seen in this life, Ryan, and I've never seen anything like this.
Ryan swiveled from their lofty perch, taking in the various icebergs surrounding them. He'd taken a compass reading again at the mouth of the access tunnel, and it had showed that their iceberg was facing 8 degrees farther south than it had previously.
Phew! All them icebergs look like a herd.
And all headed south for the winter.
As they watched, one of the icebergs went completely to pieces.
You have to wonder where all those pieces of ice come from. Makes me curious about what it must have looked like during the fiercest part of the cold after the nuclear winter.
Probably like nothing you'd ever want to see. I got no curiosity about seeing it. Be glad when we get off this one.
Yeah, I've been small all my life, but seeing this, going through that gateway like you people call it, makes me feel real small.
We're all small when you get right down to it. It's up to a person how big of a footprint they want to leave when they step out of this life. That's what Trader always said. Let's move out. Jack, you and me are gonna run point. Dean, you're walking drag with JB. Make sure you don't lose sight of him, and he doesn't lose sight of you. Mildred, Christy, you two are walking in the middle. Kinda loose wing positions. Not gonna need to get spread out too far, because we're gonna keep this narrow. Doc, you and Albert are next.
I have only one small question, my dear Ryan.
What, Doc?
How do you propose we find our way back to this place?
Got the compass.
And with the shifting this deep-sea diamond in the rough is doing, I do not think you can count on the readings you are going to get from that compass.
If we get enough of a drift, even the mini-sextant isn't going to be much use, especially if we get in a hurry.
Fire blast.
Ryan looked out at the white expanse of broken terrain before him.
It's one bastard big rock, but how lost can we get?
Ryan kept them moving with the ocean always to the right. If nothing else, they would walk in a giant circle. The problem would be to effectively search the center of the ice mass. Snow was a problem too. Piles of it covered the surface, making it necessary to test footing before stepping down through it. Only Jack's cat-quick reflexes had saved him from dropping through a fissure in the iceberg that was 30 feet deep. After an hour of moving through the cold and the snow, Ryan had called a break. They huddled in a little group on the lee side of a massive upthrust of ice that shielded them from most of the wind. They ate double helpings of the self-heats they carried with them from the redoubt. All of them knew the dangers of exposure and knew that they were burning extra calories simply by being out in the cold. Even Ryan, as hardened as he was to the harsh life in Deathlands, couldn't help feeling a little doubtful about their chances.
You're thinking too hard, lover.
I can't help thinking that this is a fuck-all place to be.
There's a way, lover.
Christy touched his face with her gloved hand, and he hated it that the cold had robbed him of the sensation. But the gesture meant a lot.
Over, under, or around, there's always a way. You taught me that.
We'll get it done. We haven't ever been stopped before.
Was that...
Yeah. We're not alone.
Ryan took the lead, matching himself with Jack. He stayed low to the terrain, feeling the added moisture of his breath starting to cake up the handkerchief around his lower face. He held the stire at the ready in both hands, but kept the sweatshirt he'd taken from the clothing bins in the redoubt wrapped around the rifle to keep the action from freezing. Jack paced him 20 yards away, a pale ghost running against the snow-covered backdrop. Somewhere up ahead, serious gunplay was being dealt out. Ryan felt more hopeful about the situation. JB's mini-sextant had revealed they were in the Arctic Circle, somewhere below Greenland, if that place still yet existed. But guns meant men, and men usually meant some way of surviving. He was even further encouraged by the sounds of running engines. Images of boats filled his mind, and he figured that he never really thought about how good a boat could look until he was thinking about them at that moment. The land rose up before Ryan, but it was so white and so like the rest of the terrain that he couldn't tell the difference until he noticed that his angle to the ground had changed. His calf muscles ached from the increased fatigue, the cold, and running uphill. Then he cleared the edge, scanning it tight against the orange skyline for just a moment. The iceberg dropped away below him, cutting inward in a bowl-shaped depression from the shoreline. Nearly 40 people scrambled for cover below, dodging bullets fired at them from 8 men ringed around them. The engine noises came from 2 small airwags that glided over them like giant hornets. The airwags weren't true planes. Ryan had seen pics of those before. These were little more than seats with wings and a pusher prop behind. The wings were nearly 3 times the length of a man, though the body of the plane might have been barely as long as a man was tall. The 40 people running for their lives didn't have weapons, except for bows, arrows, and spears. They dressed in furs and homespun clothing. The gunners used full-scale assault weapons and moved in a definite military pattern. Luckily, they seemed to be selective in their targets. Otherwise, every person down there would have been dead. At another time, in another place, Ryan might not have been so quick to get involved. He'd seen massacres before, had taken part in some of them. A man wanting to keep his head on his shoulders where it belonged also kept his nose where it belonged. That had been one of the trader's earliest remembered sayings. But the companions were trapped on the iceberg, which was definitely not long for the world. The gunners had assault weapons and obviously a purpose for being there. Ryan had to ask himself, who would willingly stay on a sinking iceberg? The other people, dressed in their furs and their homespun clothing, gave him the impression of being native to the area, and there was no better source of information than a local. One of the fur-clad men rose from behind a boulder, an arrow fitted to his string. He loosed it, and it crossed the distance to their attackers, catching the target in the chest. Before the bowman could get back to cover, however, he was targeted. Ryan settled in behind the stire, bracing it on the ground, and easing the barrel past the ledge. He knew he would have only a few seconds surprise working on his side before the gunners knew he was among them. He sighted on the middle of his targets, not going for a headshot because the chances were so slim. 2 of the gunners were down when Ryan dropped the crosshairs on the third. He moved his head automatically from the telescopic lens. If he had possessed 2 eyes, moving on to his next target would have been simply a matter of shifting the emphasis of his vision to his other eye. With 1, he had to force the shift. Ryan moved to a 4th target. The man shifted behind cover, trying to get out of the line of fire. Suddenly, a few of the fur-clad warriors pushed themselves free and rushed the 3 surviving men on the ground. The small airwags fought to gain altitude and come around. Both of them had light machine guns mounted on the front of their craft. One of them got a line on Ryan. The ice ledge in front of Ryan seemed to go to pieces, hammered by the machine gun rounds. Giving up his position, Ryan rolled on his side to escape the barrage. He scrambled on hands and knees to get back to cover, then brought up the stire again. By that time, one of the airwags was almost on top of him. Out of control, the airwag flew straight for the ice cliff just below Ryan. Ryan felt the heat wash over him as he chambered around and sighted the stire back on the killing site. 2 of the fur-clad men had overrun one of the 2 surviving men on the ground. The last ground gunner was making tracks, heading over the ridge. Ryan led the man slightly. He searched grimly for the last airwag, seeing it fleeing the battle area and streaking away straight out to sea. Before it went far, an albatross swooped down from the sky, maybe merely coming in for a better look, and maybe to defend its chosen territory. The pilot couldn't avoid the big bird. He tried to bank his craft, but the albatross pursued, running straight over his head into the pusher prop. The airwag dropped into the ocean and disappeared in a heartbeat.
Gone!
Ryan nodded, confirming Jack's statement. Still, he waited for a while in case they had both been wrong. It wasn't likely, and it didn't happen. He turned, knowing JB could see him. The armorer had held his position with the others in case Jack and Ryan had been forced to abandon theirs. Ryan waved them up. Then he stood and started down the steep side of the bowl-shaped depression, wondering whose fight he'd interrupted and which side he'd joined. More than anything, he hoped the fur-clad people had a way off the iceberg. He didn't relish the thought of being adrift somewhere in the Arctic Circle, but it beat the hell out of drowning. Ryan kept the styre in both hands as he walked down the incline. Despite the help he had given them, the fur-clad people hadn't chosen to come out of hiding. The line of warriors shifted, coming on point to face him. Since there appeared to be only one of him, they were braver. One of the warriors stood and approached Ryan. He carried an ice axe in his hands. Someone had altered the handle, though, adding a 4-foot-long bone shank instead of the foot-long metal handle, increasing the weapon's reach. Ryan halted just out of what he considered to be easy bow and arrow range. Through the narrow face of his hood, the fur-clad warrior looked Indian. His features were dark, with marked cheekbones, his hair a raven's wing black. He wore fur mittens that covered his hands but allowed him to use his axe freely.
Hello, friend.
You speak English?
Yes.
You're Russian?
No.
Then what?
I'm from a place called Deathlands. Heard of it?
No.
Had another name a long time ago. Called itself the United States.
American?
I guess so. Those men were Russian?
Yeah.
Who are you?
My name's Harlan. I'm chief of this tribe. Have you got boats?
I was hoping you would have.
How did you get here?
That's a long story, Chief.
I don't have time for a long story. As soon as Vitkin finds out his search and capture team is dead, he's gonna come hunting.
The alliance between the Companions and the fur-clad people was uneasy. Ryan and his small group sat together, except for Doc and Mildred, who helped with the wounded. The medkits they had packed in the redoubt to carry them through their excursion exhausted quickly, but most of the Inuit were taken care of. Ryan knew that Chief Harlan didn't buy his story about having been part of a trading ship that had blown off course and went down only a short distance from the iceberg, but the Inuit leader didn't press the issue. Ryan didn't want to give up the gateway or the redoubt if he could help it. Harlan's own story was that he and his tribe were trying to get some of their people back from the Russian captain, Gottfried Vitkin, after the chunk of glacier had split off from the main mass. Harlan said his ancestors had been part of a scientific observation team in the Arctic Circle at the time of the Nukost, and they'd been taken in by the Inuit.
The quakes had gotten worse than usual in the area lately. Still, no one expected all the ice masses to tear free the way they had. We tracked this iceberg for 2 days before we found the right one.
Where are your boats?
Vitkin's sailor shot them up. We got caught coming onto the iceberg less than an hour ago. Vitkin's gotta be getting desperate.
Why? If he's a captain, then he's got a ship.
He's got a ship, all right. But it's mired in the ice. Been there since skydark.
Vitkin has a ship?
The ship is called the Red Star of Glory. The Russians were some sort of strike team sent into the area to take out some secret base the Americans were supposed to have. Who knows if any of that is true? Vitkin's father's father, or something like that, so the story goes, was the original captain of the ship. Supposed to have been some other ships, but they all got lost in a battle. Only thing that survived was the Red Star of Glory, and it's locked up in the ice. The battle between the Russians and my people, the Inuit, has gone on for decades. We started out trading back 60 years earlier when our tribe had found the Russians.
But now Vitkin has some of your people?
Yeah. See, back in those days, you didn't find many Russian sailor women. Vitkin's ancestor, to keep up the population, started trading with the Inuit people, other tribes than ours, and traded a few guns for young women. Chiefs made the deals. Up here, a large tribe is a pain in the ass to take care of. You're always on the move, always looking for enough food to get you by.
Well, it seems to me that the Russians would have the same problems. Did they trade for food?
A little. Stuff that they wanted. They had a lot of stores on ship, though. and the original Captain Vitkin didn't want to become dependent on the Inuit.
Except for women.
Right. After a while, he started raising his own women. Didn't want to lose the Russian bloodline, you see.
How inbred are they?
Doc approached the group with Mildred.
Pretty badly.
Got a lot of stale genes. Those dead guys I got a look at have mismatched arms and legs, cranial problems, cleft palates, no chins, and an assortment of other prime indicators that Daddy's not been running far from the old homestead.
That's what the latest Captain Vitkin was doing when he captured our people. Trying to add to his blood stock. After his father started killing some of the Inuit who came to trade with him, getting medicines and guns, everybody said, fuck him, who needs it? They go out, pound a seal to death when it's asleep, add a new set of clothes, fat for their lanterns if they had or wanted them, and meat for a week. Russians were the ones who needed something.
But he captured your people?
Sure. We let him.
Why?
Vitkin has guns. With the ice breaking up the way it has, hunting and fishing areas among the Inuit are getting more tense. Man who has the most guns is going to get the hunt and fish. Everybody else is going to starve. Me? I intend to have a bigger tribe.
And to do what?
Maybe go south?
A lot of ocean to cover.
Vikings did it, in really small boats.
Then why let Vitkin capture your people? Seems stoop.
Actually, it's a pretty smart thing to do. Vitkin's numbers aboard the ship have gotten low. They're having a lot of stillborn lately because their gene pool's so messed up. But the Russian sailors are lazy. They get our women on the ship, they have sex with them, hope they turn up pregnant, and use them as slaves to cook and clean.
You sent those girls into that?
That's cruel.
But I asked for volunteers. I had four girls who said they would go. No pressure from me. Sex is sex. Enjoyed sex a time or two with a couple of them myself. You've got to have something to do when it's too cold to go out and do anything else. Hated to see them go. And they were trading off a few months of discomfort against a training that would make them valuable.
As maids and gaudy sluts?
I don't know about gaudy sluts.
A girl who sells sex for money.
No. Making babies, cooking, and cleaning aren't the only things the girls get to do. Vitkin also puts them to work making reloads for their weapons and doing some repair work on the guns. Do you know how much those girls will be in demand when they get away from the Russians?
Why hasn't anyone ever done it before?
Hell, they have. You think I thought of this all on my own? A lot of Inuit tribes who have chiefs like me have thought of this. I bet there's 9 tribes I know of right now who've benefited from their girls getting on the Russian ship, then escaping and bringing back the knowledge they learned. This is just business. Why do you think the Russians try to hang on to their own gene pool so long? They have sex with the second and third generations because the kids generally won't try to escape the ship. Soon as they're born and up and around, the Russians kill the mother. Or the mother escapes and leaves them there because it's too hard to escape carrying a baby.
But the more the Inuit learn from the Russians, the less reason they have to go back.
Exactly. Got a tribe who sent a few girls in to learn the hydroponics procedure the Russians developed on the ship. Got 2 girls back, which is a pretty good return. That was 20 years ago. Now they're set up in a vill on a coastline where they can reach the dirt, put in some of the seeds the Russians got from gutting the birds in the area, and raise a few vegetables that hadn't been seen in this area before. Other tribes worked themselves to death finding things to trade them.
The Russians had a hydroponics farm set up on the ship?
No. They set one up after they found out how trapped they were.
A goodly number of the sailors for the Russians at the time were men taken from the collective farms. They were conscripted by the government to learn the Navy after learning how to farm in bleak conditions, sometimes not too unlike what we're seeing here. It makes sense that some of the crew would be able to put a hydroponics farm together.
How long have your girls been on board the ship?
3 months, give or take a couple weeks. The plan was to leave them there for 3 months. They got ways of keeping themselves from getting pregnant too easy. Then this quake hit and set this iceberg loose. The tribes, we all saw it coming. Just figured we had more time.
How many Russians do you think there are?
Able and willing to fight us?
Yeah.
20, maybe as many as 40.
JB, what do you think?
If Harlan's people join in, it puts us closer to even. We wait until dark, give them time to bed down. Maybe it'll get a little easier if we can put a boarding party onto the ship and reduce the numbers before all hell breaks loose.
Ryan nodded, then looked around at the rest of the group, waiting. Everyone was in favor of throwing their lot in with the Inuit and taking the Russian ship.
We don't really have a choice if we want to get off this iceberg, lover.
Wow, that was a big one.
Ryan turned back to the chief.
Let's go take a look at that ship.
Ryan scanned the big ship from stem to stern with his field glasses. He noted some movement on her decks. Evidently, Captain Vidkin had gotten disturbed about his search and capture team's failure to reappear, and had put out extra guards.
Russian frigate. Probably the Krivik class, type 2. The 3s had